This is Bounded Tatatari 8-bit Podcast.
Hello, this is Randy Kindig, and I want to welcome you to this interview-only episode of Antic, the Atari 8-bit Podcast. This interview is with Mr. Marty Goldberg, who, along with Kurt Vindel, authored the book Atari Inc. Business is Fun, and is working on the follow-up volumes. This interview is really timely in that a new cover for the second edition of Atari Inc. Business is Fun was just announced shortly before this interview aired. And there also was an announcement regarding the second book of the series, Atari Corp. Business is War. Marty is a writer and programmer in the video game industry, is a freelancer for Retro Gamer magazine, is co-founder of the Midwest Gaming Classic, and founded the Electronic Entertainment Museum. I greatly appreciate the time Marty spent with us for this interview. Enjoy! So, are you familiar with the Antic Podcast?
Yes, I am.
Okay. So, I just want to talk with you a little bit. I know there's a lot of interest out there in the books that you've worked on with Kurt and that you are working on with Kurt.
Right.
And I also just wanted to find out a little bit about you. I mean, I know a lot of people in the Atari community know you fairly well, but, everyone may not be familiar with you and your background. Can you talk a little bit about your background? So, did you grow up with Atari computers?
I grew up with Atari consoles. We were actually an early adopter. Got the 2600 VCS when it first came out in 77. And then I had friends that had Atari computers. I mean, the first actual computer I had was an Atari 520 SD. So,
that was your first computer, huh?
Yeah, before that I was actually using a terminal. Terminals to call up BBSs. It was my dad's terminal with the company he was with. So, it was a pretty neat one. It's called the Display Phone. It was by Northern Telecom out of Canada. And it was way ahead of its time. It was a built-in communications device that had a screen, small built-in TV screen with any column card, a pull-out keyboard. You had your phone attached right to it. It had a 300 or 1200 baud modem. Built into it and had a lot of features like a memo pad and a directory. So I used to use that to call up BBSs a lot until I got my own computer.
Okay. You must be a little younger if your first computer was an Atari ST. I mean, that didn't come out till the late 80s, mid to late 80s. So.
85. I'm not that much younger than you probably. I don't know. I mean, I'm 43, so.
No, you're younger than me.
Okay.
I guess I'm assuming that you're mainly an Atari guy. Is that true, or do you have a lot of other computers, or do you have interest in other vintage computers as well?
Yeah, I specialize in Atari.
Okay.
But I'm actually, because I run an archive called the Electronic Entertainment Museum, or E2M, that basically specializes in the entire video game industry and the early computer industry. So yeah, I've got lots of different, I've got pretty much every game console and peripheral from 1972 till around the, I'd say early 90s. Computers as well. I mean, my earliest computer is MSI 8080 that I actually rescued and had to take time to build back up again. But like I said, I try and cover the entirety of both industries, but I specialize in Atari.
Okay. Well, yeah, sounds like you've got a pretty large collection of computers.
Yeah, it's fairly extensive. It's because it's a full archive. Kurt and I both treat what we have as an actual archive, so we take time and care to professionally preserve everything and to try and work with museums and other people that request resources. So, I mean, we run it exactly like an actual archive.
Oh, wow. Well, that's pretty interesting. So you had, you said you had an Atari ST in the mid-80s. And then so at what point did you get into vintage computers? Did you go into the PC realm for a while and then come back to vintage computers, or
Well, I used my ST from when I got it in about 85 until I'd say about the mid-90s. And
you used it for quite a while then, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was my main computer. And then I got pulled kicking and screaming into the PC clone world. Mm-hmm. So that was around just before Windows 95 came out. So I started briefly with Windows 3.1 and then went to 95, etc. And then it was really around the late 90s that I got into the whole retro gaming and vintage computing, etc. And that's actually what drew me to the first part of it that is really a professional aspect in my life, which was ClassicGaming.com, which was... under the company, they were called GameSpy at the time. They since merged with IGN, and it was IGN GameSpy for a time. And I think they kind of wiped out the GameSpy brand. I'm not sure by now. But I actually got involved with that site around 99, 2000, and then wound up eventually taking over as the site administrator and editor, et cetera, for a number of years, too. So, and that's really where my growth as far as wanting to archive materials professionally and really trying to become a professional historian came from, because it was actually written into my contract that I had to keep up my knowledge and continue to expand it with relation to the subject of the site I was on. At that time, they had GameSpy had all the Planet sites. So there was like Planet Nintendo, Planet Sega, etc. And ClassicGaming.com was also a Planet site, even though it wasn't called that. So everybody that ran a Planet site really had to be on top of their game and have extensive knowledge of what they were covering, because obviously you're getting article submissions. You've got to know what, you know, what's being submitted and what's good, what isn't. You've got to know how to edit it, etc. So that's really where I started to work on and really delve into research on the gaming industry and the computing industries as well. And, you know, it just became a big passion from there.
So are you still involved with that? With the
I left them around, how long has it been now? Around 2006, I think it was.
Okay.
Not long after the merger with IGN, and then things started changing, and then they got rid. One of the big things with ClassicGaming.com is it used to host a ton of sites of people, you know, in the scene sites, and then they decided, the powers that be decided to get rid of it, and that kind of killed the whole thing. And, you know, too, when I first started there was a full staff of people, and eventually towards the end, it got down to just me. And they certainly weren't paying enough for a person to do, you know, enough of what they wanted. They still wanted the same site that was there before when it had the full staff, but they wanted one person doing it, which was impossible. Mm-hmm. And so then I offered to stay on to help out for free, and then it just, you know, kind of fizzled from there, and I haven't really had much to do with it for a while. So, you know, and I've been really too busy with all the other endeavors too, because, you know, there's, again, E2M archive takes up a lot of time, plus my work with the Atari Museum archive, and then, you know, the books with Kurt, and then we also have Legacy Engineering, which is now called Syzygy Company. You know, all the work we've done with that, with the products, with creating the flashback line and some of the other, and doing gaming work for different contracts and that. And
okay, so you were involved with that as well then. We had Kurt on the show. I interviewed him for Antic, and he talked about that for a while, and I guess I wasn't aware that you were involved with that as well.
Yeah, we're actually partners in the company.
Okay.
And actually, with Syzygy Company, we actually partnered with original Atari co-founder Ted Dabney in there.
Oh, okay.
So he's involved with that, too. Yeah, it's been really great. He's a great guy. But, and then, too, which I'm sure you've heard of, is Midwest Gaming Classic. So I'm one of the co-founders of that. And that takes up time as well, you know, throughout the year, and especially when it gets closer to the show as well. So there just really wasn't a lot of time to be involved with ClassicGaming.com anymore. And I think the site anyway right now is almost like a museum. They don't really do anything much with it.
So you're involved with the Midwest Gaming Classic.
Yes.
And refresh my memory. When does that occur? Is that a once a year thing?
It's a once a year show. It was in the past years in March. We found it back in 2001. And now we're one of the largest electronic entertainment expos in the country itself. Well over 50,000 square feet. I believe our attendance this past year for a two-day show was in the 9,000 realm. 9,000 people over the 2 days.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, it's been phenomenal. It's taken a lot of growth and infrastructure, and we've really worked hard to try and keep it that it's not turning into a corporate type show. No matter how big we get, we still keep the flavor that it's a show by fans and for fans. So, and that was always important to us. And we cover all the realms equally, too. Consoles, computers, arcade games, and arcade including pinball. And we cover everything from past to present. So it covers modern games and consoles, etc., just as much as it does the retro stuff. So we're not really a retro show. The classic in classicgaming.com is really derived from the fact that everything is a classic to somebody at some point, whether it's a four-year-old who loved the game that they played and it's going to be classic to them for years to come from now, or something that was released 10, 15, 30 years ago. Something's a classic to everybody, and we really try and celebrate that fact and celebrate gamers too. Mm-hmm. Plus, we have the usual industry speakers there, presentations. We have the IGDA usually does a meeting there as well and a big talk. Coin ops, I think we had over 400 this past year. We have one of the largest, when the show is, it's pretty much the largest arcade in the country at that time. It's phenomenal when you see that too. And then we have a lot of legendary after parties and things like that. But we draw people, we're based in the Midwest, it's in the Milwaukee area. But it really draws people from all over the country and the world, too. We've had people come from Europe, from Japan, from Australia, just all over the place. It's been phenomenal.
Yeah, it looks like an amazing event. I live in the Midwest as well, Indianapolis.
Okay.
So it's not too far, but it's a little ways. I should definitely try to get to this sometime, though. So it's always in Milwaukee?
Yeah, it's in the Milwaukee area. It's just in the outskirts. We pretty much take over the whole hotel convention center. And it's just, it's a lot of fun. And, a good bulk of the people, too, actually, that come in from out of town stay for the whole weekend. Because, again, we have all those after parties that they're all welcome to be a part of as well. And a lot of the areas are open for staff or the people staying in the hotel, too, after hours. Especially for the people that are working the show or the people that are displaying at the show, because they don't really have time during the day because it's so crowded and busy that, we like to give them time for that too. And we started actually having entertainment at night too, brought in different bands and other stuff going on. So and we've even expanded in the last couple of years. There's been people in traditional role-playing and board games and things like that have wanted an area there too, so we've tried to accommodate that as well. Because obviously Milwaukee has its history with Gen Con in the past, because that was founded in the area.
I guess I wanted to talk about the books a little bit, right?
Sure.
So you have been involved with Kurt on the books, and like I said, I had him on the show when we talked about Business is Fun. It was shortly after Business is Fun had come out. And I know you guys recently announced that Business is War is pre-announced. I mean, you don't know exactly when it's going to come out yet, but I believe that's correct, right?
Yes.
You're just kind of pre-announcing that it's coming. And I know you were planning a trilogy, I think, for the whole thing. Is that correct?
Yes, that would be correct. There are three books in the series. It's an actual trilogy. So the first one was Atari Inc. Business is Fun. Then it's Atari Corp. Business is War. Is the next one is coming. And then after that, it's Atari Games Last and Fun.
Okay. So how did this all get started? I'd like to hear your part of this. How did you and Kurt decide to do all of this? So, what kind of prompted the whole thing?
Well, we had both been working on separate efforts because we had been working on this on our own books years ago with related to this. And actually, at one time, Kurt was actually partnered with Leonard Herman of Phoenix fame. And that their project never really went anywhere for, you know, whatever reason that was. And then Kurt and I started working together with, you know, with the Flashback and a few other things and decided, okay, why don't we, you know, we like working together. We both complement each other as far as, you know, our research abilities and our thought processes, et cetera. And so, you know, why don't we work together and just, you know, do a book together. And then through the talks, it became, well, we're really going to need to do this right. And so we're going to need to do a couple of books, you know. And that was the interesting thing with this too, because Business is Fun was actually closer to 900 pages, and we still could have filled more. And we actually had to cut it back to 800 at the last minute because of CreateSpace, which is Amazon's self-publishing business. That's who we published through, and they have about an 820-page limit. So, you know, and that's been the problem. And that was one of the reasons, too, from the very beginning, we had also decided we had a vision for what we want these books to be, what we want them to encompass, and we want to stand firm on that. So we knew going to a regular publisher was going to have issues or cause issues with that, because most of the publishers, even since then that we've talked to, they usually want to cut it in half. And they don't want half the material that we felt was very important and that people actually complimented us on having. You know, a lot of the inside material that hasn't really been explained or shown before. They also like to do images in like what I call a ghetto in the center of the book. And we wanted to have lots and lots of images in this for people to do. And that's where I came up with the idea of really approaching it almost like a college textbook, where when you have a college textbook, at the end of every chapter, you have a review of the chapter. So I thought it would be cool to combine that with the images and do a review of the chapter in images so that they're all related chronologically into what the chapter just covered. So that, you know, that's something novel that we did with that too. And, you know, obviously, like Kurt has mentioned previously, too, in interviews, there were some issues, and a lot of that had to do with the time frame that we had. We did have an editor in the book. Again, this was self-published, and the time frame of trying to get it out in time for the 40th anniversary, which was that year 2012, was just, you know, neither one of us were getting any sort of sleep whatsoever on that, trying to get all these things written and rewritten and compiling everything and getting the layout. You know, I had to do the entire layout by hand in InDesign, and just trying to just get the entire process done. And in the meantime, we've got the Kickstarter backers breathing down our necks. Where is it? You promised it here. There are people that had done pre-orders as well at one point that, you know, where is it? So at one point then we just had to say, okay, this is as good as it's going to get right now. And, you know, we have to publish. And that's what we did in the end of November 2012, trying to time it with the original marketing of Pong 40 years before. Mm-hmm. And figured, okay, what we'll do is we'll try and fix some things in the interim and put in, because, you know, because it's all digital and it's digitally uploaded, so we'll try and, you know, update a few of the typos and grammar things that we said along the way. And then at some point we decided, because of some of the feedback we were getting with people in those regards, okay, we're really going to need to do a full second edition. So that's what we've been working on a lot too. And the big thing with that and with the second book is we're not going to give firm release dates on those again. And we're not going to put any sort of time limit on it, because we want to make sure everything is done right and everything how we want it to be as well. So, you know, this whole thing was a learning process for us too, which, you know, we've streamlined the process now for the second book, but, you know, this was the first book we had done together, the first book either one of us had done, period. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and going the self-publishing create space route was really a learning experience too, because again, when you're self-publishing, you have to do all your own promotional material and all your own promoting. It's entirely grassroots, because you obviously don't have a publisher doing it for you. You don't have the connections.
Right.
So we had to spend a lot of, I mean, pretty much everything we earned in the book for sales over this time has gone right back into either promoting the book or, say, to paying for these two covers that we're having done, because we're having a new cover done for the first book as well, for the second edition of that. You know, and it's, the problem is the way the book industry is made, it favors the publishers. And what I mean by that is a bookstore will not stock your book if it's print on demand, which is what most self-publishing is, especially CreateSpace, because they can't return the book because they're used to doing that with books that don't sell. They, including when they mark them down and try and get rid of them, whatever doesn't sell, they can usually return for credit.
Right.
With the publisher, you can't do that with print on demand books. Huh. So immediately, right there, you're cut out of any brick and mortar sales.
Oh wow!
Yeah, so that, you know, that hurt us a lot too, and that left us with the online presence being our only avenue. Mm-hmm. So you know, and that's why again, you know, it's very hard to get the word about the book out there. Most of the companies that we did talk to since then, the publishers, again, either completely wanted to cut the book in half and change so much of it, it would have been unrecognizable for what we wanted to present and wanted to have in there and make sure the fans had in there. Plus, we would have been lucky if we got 5% of our own book sales, because you're signing over, obviously, all the sales to them, and they just give you a very, very small percentage of that. We would have lost any sort of control, again, creative control, so that if, like now, when we're going to do a second edition, they would have complete control over whether or not we'd be able to do that and whatever changes we wanted to do, mm-hmm. including adding additional content, shifting content around, removing some content, etc. You know, the other learning process too is with the pre-orders, which we're never going to do again, because we basically got screwed by Amazon payments with that. It was such a horrible system to work through, but that's all we could do through CreateSpace and Amazon, because that's obviously they use their payment system for that. So anybody that half the people that pre-ordered, we actually didn't get notices for. And then once we did, a lot of times it took forever to get the money released. So for a lot of these people, when we did release the books, they didn't get their, you know, we actually had to pay out of pocket for the books plus the shipping. We don't see when somebody orders a book through Amazon, usually gets super saver shipping and things like that. Mm-hmm. We have to pay full shipping for every book. So it, you know, it basically ate up a lot of money, especially when you're sending books to Europe at, you know, $25 to $35 a pop for shipping for a single book. And, you know, so that, again, that's what I'm talking about with our money being immediately put back into this for anything that we got. So, you know, it was just, yeah, it was just a complete mess. And then what pissed people off too with the pre-orders are that, basically, in order for us to get copies of the book, we have to get it the same as everybody else. What that means, because it's print on demand. So what that means is we go into the CreateSpace backend system and we physically order a copy of the book. Now, what that means also means is in order to do that in their system, we need to make the book available. So then everybody that pre-ordered was also, rightly so, ticked off that, okay, the book's opened up for ordering, and here's all these people coming in, getting copies of the book, ordering it right online, and the pre-orders haven't gotten theirs yet.
Right, yeah.
So, you
That's
know,
it, a good it was, situation.
Yeah, it was a complete mess. So, like, you know, we learned from a lot of that stuff, and we know how we're going to approach it this time around for the second book and the second edition of the first book, and, you know, really try and minimize a lot of this nonsense that went on.
Well, it it sounds like you had a lot of issues there that you're able to learn from. It must not have been too bad because you decided to go ahead with the second book and have plans for the third book. So you must have worked through it.
Yeah, well, I mean, we were, regardless of all this, we knew from the beginning we were going to continue through with these three books, whether the first book sold well or not, or whether any of the other books sell well or not. This is, you know, it's a passion for us, and that's really why we did this. That, and we really wanted to honor the people that worked there. That's one thing over and over again. We told the people when we were interviewing them is, this book is really for you guys and for you to tell your story. That's one thing we didn't want to do with any of these books too, is the usual, you know, past efforts, whether it was Zap, which is universally known as a horrible, horrible book as far as accuracy, or whether you're talking about Ultimate History of Video Games or some of the other video game history books, they mainly deal with a lot of the same stories and a lot of the same big name people. And we really wanted to let everybody from the ground up try and have their say in these books. Obviously because of size constraints, we couldn't fit everybody that we even wanted to in the first book or in the other books. Because again, that's we would have well over 1,000 pages, if it was up to us. But, and that's exactly why we're trying to do like blog updates on the Atari book site. And we're even knocking around the idea of maybe doing some companion books after these two to fit in some of the other stories and things that we couldn't fit into these books. But really, again, these books are meant to be a testament to the people that work there, and really try and give the sense and impression of what it was like to work there for these people.
Yeah, and I think that's great that you guys are doing this. I mean, this is, like you said, it's a story that needs to be told, and I think there's a lot of interest out there. Atari is still a pretty big name out there, and there's a lot of interest. So, have you been happy with the sales of the book? Has the interest been pretty high?
Yeah, I mean, without going into too much about how many copies have been sold, typical sales we were told for a self-published book are around 500 copies. And we've gone way, way over that.
Oh, great. Okay.
And a big part of it too was the people who run what's called the Storybook Bundle, which are some people that are involved with the big Game Developers Conference out in California. Some people from that run the Story Bundle effort, which is basically they go around to a bunch of different authors and ask if they can bundle in the ebook version of their books together for people to buy as a bundle. And they have a suggested price, and then people can actually pay what they want for the bundle.
I saw that.
Yes.
I actually came across that, yeah.
So that, that alone, I mean, the amount of copies we sold from being a part of that bundle really shot up our copy number. But at the same time, like I mentioned before, we reinvested that money immediately. So all the money that we made from that actually went into getting these two covers done, right away, because we hired a great, great painter and artist with Lucas Kettner. And he's done an amazing job, working with us, getting what exactly we wanted, the vision we were trying to capture in these as well. And, it's been a pleasure working with the guy too. But again, he's a professional painter and artist, so it does cost money. So we immediately reinvested all that into that. That's something we've constantly done with this. So, yeah, this wasn't a project that we're going to make, I saw some complaints on some forums of people that were complaining back when from the whole pre-order thing, were accusing us of like being off in the Caribbean somewhere with our money and stuff like that. It's like,
what money are you talking about?
Yeah. honestly, what money? And, the paltry amount of money that we've been able to not have to reinvest, we're lucky if we could pay a phone bill a couple months you know, the cable bill, let alone thousands of dollars to fly to the Caribbean and stay in a hotel or something, you know, or a resort. Right. I mean,
it's just amazing what people will say in situations like that. It's you know, and what you're saying is really a kind of a common theme. I've talked to several vintage computer book authors, and they all pretty much say the same thing. You don't do it to make money. You do it because you love it and you want to get the story out there and there's interest, but you don't do it to get rich. Nobody has any ideas that they're going to get rich from it.
Oh, yeah, and that's very true. And, you know, and that's the thing, too, like what we heard when we approached a lot of publishing companies in the interim again, because we still wanted to try and get a color version of the book out, which has been impossible to do. But a lot of the publishers we talked to were like, well, video game books don't sell, or video game history books don't sell. So that's very true. Whether it's a video game book or a computer book or, you know, anything in between, they're very hard to get anything more than just the core hardcore audience with.
At least with a name like Atari, though, I think it does draw in. Yeah, because it was so popular 30 years ago, 35 years ago, you know, there are a lot of people who have memories of Atari, and that probably draws some people in that are not hardcore.
Well, one would hope.
Yeah.
One would hope. That's precisely why we tried to write the book in the way that it was written, which is extremely accessible instead of a technical book, because we wanted to reach that wide audience we were intending to. And that's going to be something in the second edition, too, of this book, of Atari and Business is Fun, that's going to be even more obvious, too. Once that writing style, I mean, that main style was really only prevalent in the first quarter to the first third of the book, simply because of, again, of how we had to really rush things to get things out for the 2012. So one of the things I'm doing with this book is trying to make sure the entire thing is in one voice, which is really that, for me, it's a testament to the writing style of, I can't think of his name right now. I'll email you later on it. It's really meant to be like that insider type snarky, writing style where you're actually it's a bit first person, you know, for the writing, and you're there getting the inside scoop and the inside story and really experiencing things as they're happening, but also reflecting on its place in the culture and the history of now as well, or, you know, and what will happen. So that sort of voice in the first part of the book is really going to be throughout this time, and that's really to make it as accessible as possible to people.
Without pinning you down, because I know you guys are not wanting to put dates out there or anything, but I'm just curious as to how far along in the process you are with the second book. It sounds like you're close to at least having all of the material in there, and you're looking for editors. Is that correct? Is that where you're at in the process?
What we wanted to do, too, is try and get more of the people involved that were basically criticizing some of the editing the first time around. So that's why I put out the call out there for people, for the fans and for other people to get involved. We really want people that can really demonstrate some kind of editing background, you know, at least some ability for it, but also they're going to have to understand we have a certain style and aspect that we want to maintain in this. It's not a formal book. We don't want a formal writing style. That was a problem with a couple editors that we had worked tryouts in the past, where they immediately wanted to go to more of a formal book editing style or writing style, and that's not what we're looking for.
So but it sounds like you're getting close to the point where you're going to have people starting to help you edit the book, right? So you must have most of the material put together for it?
Well, a lot of that call too was for really for the rewrites of the first book too. But yeah, we're working on both together. They're simultaneous. Okay. The person I was trying to think of where I was drawing a memory blank was Kringley, Robert Kringley. That's really the biggest influence as far as how I want the book to read, just a little bit of a different direction than that, but within that vein. So, you know, I'm a big fan. Obviously, that a lot of people were a big fan of his writing. And it's, you know, it's certainly timeless the way you can go back and read a lot of his articles. Mark Steffens is his actual name. A lot of his articles, or whether you read his books like Accidental Empires, was an amazing book. But yeah, we really want to make sure that voice is throughout the second edition of this book. And then we really want to make sure chapter to chapter the editing is done great in the second book. A big part of the problem too in the last process, because of how we were rushing for the timeline, is we were actually, as I'm laying stuff out, we were editing stuff in InDesign, in the editor itself, which is, in a normal book editing process, you have all the editing done before you go to the layout process. And there just wasn't time for that. So, I mean, that's what we want to make sure and do this time around. But, no, I was just going to say, again, in regards to the editing. So, I mean, we pretty much have everybody picked out that we're going to work with. And the goal is to have as many different eyes on a chapter, on each chapter as possible. So rather than give people, one person one chapter, another chapter, we're going to actually give these people a single chapter, have them all write back to us separately, their edits. And what'll be interesting to see is how some of them will conflict, because I know they will. You know, it's happened in the past. Because, again, people have disagreements in writing styles, and other aspects. So stylistically, that's a hard thing when you're talking about book editing. So, but we're going to do that and then take the edits as a whole and then implement them and chapter by chapter. So we really want to go through this slow and meticulous, both the second edition of the first book and this second book, Atari Corp. You know, and we're actually going to be flying out for more interviews for Atari Corp as well, a lot of in-person interviews, because that's a big part of the process as well. We're probably going to be doing that sometime in the fall.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm amazed at the amount of research that had to go into these books that you guys are putting together. I mean, it has to have been an incredible amount of research.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I don't know if you had seen the blog post about our vetting process that's up on the Atari Book site.
No, I hadn't seen that.
Yeah, we actually laid out for the public our entire vetting process. In fact, let me go to it right now.
And what's the address for that again?
AtariBook.com.
AtariBook.com.
And you can go to both sites. You can get to both sites from there. The Atari Business is Fun, which is the main site. And we have a sub-site now set up for Atari Corp Businesses War, where we'll be posting updates for that as it comes along. But, back in January of this year, I posted one called An Example of How We Vetted Info. And it goes through step-by-step our vetting process, our points. And one of being about 5 points. I mean, we basically are going by no one single source, and that's the thing. We try and vet, plus we try and isolate who we're interviewing as well. What I mean by that is we don't want to lead the witness. You know, very rare that we'd say, so the story we were told was such and such, or such and such person said this or that. Because that's called leading the witness. We want to have a very clean room response from them and hopefully verification, so that if we have two or three people bring up the same story independently, we can trust in it a little more than we could if it was just one person. For example, we had one story by Ray Kassar when we interviewed him, where he stated that he actually met with Steve Jobs in 79 about possibly having Atari buy Apple, and then having the Apple II be Atari's computer. Mm-hmm. And we went and talked to Manny Girard. Manny was the person on the Warner side who was in charge of Atari. And he said that that never happened because, well, one of the other things Ray had claimed was he went and talked to Steve Ross, the head of Warner, about it, and Steve Ross nixed it because of the amount of money Apple wanted and Steve Jobs wanted. So we talked to Manny Girard there, and he said, he basically literally said that was BS because anything that would have gone to Ross would have had to have gone through him, and that never happened with him. So we're left with an interesting story that we can't really verify. So things like that we tried to leave out of the book. If it was a situation of he said, she said type of thing, or he said, they said, we try to do both contrasting accounts and let the reader make up for it. A lot of times, too, again, we wanted to verify with other more traditional resources like paperwork, internal paperwork, the internal email system that Kurt has backups of, or whether it's notes, because we have a lot of the from the internal mainframe, the original directory structures from that. So all the files that they had in their directories, which include correspondences and notes and other things. So we try and verify with those as well. So, it's a multi-part process. There's a lot that went into it. And in fact, there's another example of that on the site of the process we went through, which was Nolan Bushnell digging up Space War, which was trying to, it started with trying to validate or disprove Nolan's claim of having seen Space War in Utah for the first time. And we found out with all the evidence, which you can see if you read the blog post, that it's not true, that the equipment wasn't there. That the equipment necessary to play wasn't there. We actually went through the Utah records for Evans, for Dr. Evans too, and we tracked down exactly what equipment was at Utah at that time. We got copies of purchase requests for the different mainframes that they eventually got. We went through, and there's an actual archive of Evans' work, including all the documentation and paperwork that he filed every time, documenting the research process. And within the time period he claimed to have seen it there, first off, there was no equipment available that would have had the display necessary for that. And when they did start to build order the equipment and build the displays for the advanced graphics system that they were working on, you could see by this paperwork that it was a very incremental process, taking over a lot of time. And they literally documented step by step that there's no way. I mean, basically the PDP that they had gotten there was being used as a graphics buffer for the other mainframe that they have. It was a UNIVAC. So basically, there was no way that it could have been appropriated to play Space War at that time. But probably the most damning evidence, too, was a video documentary we managed to get a hold of, which actually has Nolan himself in the documentary. It was filmed in 1973, and is called Games Computers Play. And it was a group of Bay Area mass communication students. There were Berkeley mass communication students who were doing filming a documentary and going around to Stanford at that time, and then they went to Atari in that summer of 73 to do footage too and do interviews. And Nolan is right there in it stating that he first saw Space War and got the idea for doing a video arcade game while he saw it at Stanford. So, it's stuff like that. It takes so long to actually do the research on that and really dot the I's and cross the T's, because we try and give everybody the benefit of the doubt, and we really want to get to the bottom of every aspect as possible. Even since this book was published, we continue to do even more research on a lot of the topics that we covered, and even those that have popped up since then. It's something that, again, why it's great that we're living in this time where we have websites where we're actually able to do some of the updates that won't fit in the book as well. Hmm. But, it's just interesting tracking down a lot of these different things. We had to do so much vetting, too, about the early years between Nolan and Ted, because, again, there was the gospel of Nolan that's been told for all these years. different stories and all that, some that have morphed over time, that we found a good bulk of them not to actually be accurate. And that was, that became an issue because the people in his camp accused us of being hostile and going after him. And we're actually big fans of everything Atari, you know, including Nolan. But it's just been frustrating with him because he has so much to be proud of and so much that he's accomplished that a lot of these tall tales or other stories that, you know, the PR that's that has been drawn up around him on purpose over the years is just so disheartening when you do the research into it and find, you know, that's either A, not how it happened, or B, it never happened.
Well, you know, the part of the issue, do you find an issue too with the fact that as time continues to march on here, people's memories start to fade or they remember things differently than what really happened? Are you finding some issues with that as more and more time passes?
With some of the people, but then that's where we can fall back on paperwork or other forms of documentation from the time.
Yeah.
Plus, one person's memory of a subject may not be as good, but another person's might be. Mm-hmm. So that's where you've got a lot of this cross-references. In the case of with the material with Nolan, it really is not that. It's really a concerted effort of building up this persona of himself in the public that started early on. I mean, one of the things that Ted told us, which was interesting, was that when the company started getting press, the first thing that he had done, according to Ted, was the first thing that Nolan had done, according to Ted, was hire a PR representative for himself and not for the company, which was very interesting. And, it, you know, it's something with a lot of these tales that have gone on since then. I mean, you look at, too, once we dug into really finding out Ted's actual involvement in the early years and how much more important than it was than we were led to believe all these years. Because when we first started this, we thought the same thing as everybody else. There, you know, yeah, I was co-founded with this guy, Ted Dabney. He got scared and ran off, and that was it. And everything else was no one. And then we started seeing that wasn't the case. He was just as instrumental. It was a partnership when it was first started. And even before that, when it was just syzygy between the two of them, it was a full partnership. And Ted was actually forced out of the company. We got verification from Nolan on that, who said it wasn't personal, it was business. So he wasn't scared at all. You know, it wasn't that he ran off. And then we started digging, you know, like it for years. You hear Nolan Bushnell, creator of Pong. Well, wait a minute. It's actually Al Elcourt created Pong. Then you can default to, okay, well, Nolan gave him the idea of it. Well, wait a minute. The idea of it came from him seeing the Magnavox Odyssey demo, which he has admitted, which Al has admitted publicly as well. In fact, I think there's a quote of an interview from Al on IGN talking, you know, relating it to an to like the play in the film, The Producers. How they thought, you know, they'd do this and use this idea and nobody would notice. Excuse me. So then it goes to, okay, well, then here's this actual aspect of where the idea of Pong came from and who actually developed the game and, you know, where it came from too. So then that attacks, in Nolan's mind, it's attacking his story that he's invested in all these years. Or same with, you know, a lot of the people in his camp, because his family is very involved in his PR and are very involved in his efforts, too. His daughter, Alyssa Bushnell, is his PR representative. You know, he's had his son, Zach, involved in his efforts, et cetera. So, and again, you know, it's we don't go into this with any idea of proving anybody wrong or right. We go into this with just trying to get as close to what happened as possible. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like I said, unfortunately, a lot of this, it was mainly Nolan's PR that suffered. A lot of the other people, yeah, there were people that, you know, I'm not sure about that. You know, my memory isn't the greatest. It happened so long ago. That would be, like I mentioned earlier, an example of where we might come back with them and say, you know, we did a little research. And then we would come back to them and say, well, so-and-so mentioned this, or we happened to find this document or this email, and then that'll jog their memory. You know, that was one of the best interviewing experiences we had was with Steve Woda. I hope I'm pronouncing his last name right. You know, Steve's a great guy, and he actually organized a meeting of ex-Atari people with us for 2 days for lunch meetings in front of the old consumer building, consumer programmers building, where, you know, Howard Scott Warshaw and Todd Fry and all those guys used to program the games, because the building's vacant. And we actually, we used some of the, they have these stone benches in front of the place that were normally used for lunch breaks there. So we actually held the lunch meetings there. We had people show up. There were a lot of the consumer guys, some of the computer guys. We had people from Coin show up over the 2 days too. So we actually did that, those particularly because of that issue, where some people might have a good memory. So we thought, okay, let's try it where if we interview all these people in the group, they might feed off of each other. And some guy, I'll say some story, bring it up, and another guy will go, oh, yeah, and remember such and such too, and things like that. And that's actually what happened. You know, it was a really good time. And the stories we got out of that, and some of those people actually hadn't seen each other since the mid-'80s. Too. So they were coming up and hugging each other, and you know, we got pictures of that. What was cool is the first day, towards the end, the guy that was the maintenance guy, or the you know, person in charge of the maintenance of the building, showed up and was going to go inside. And a couple of the guys asked if we could go in there, and he said, sure, you know, because they had told them that they used to work there when it was part of Atari. So we actually got to go into their building. And, you know, that they worked in all those years ago, and actually walk around with them as they reminisced, which was, you know, an incredible experience for us as fans. I mean, you just can't plan something like that. It was so spur of the moment, and it's just, you know, it's lightning in a bottle. It was just great.
Yeah, I wondered how you made so many contacts at Atari to do your research. So, I mean, it sounds like that's how you went about it.
Well, we've had, you know, Kurt's had a lot of contacts over the years, obviously, because of the Atari Museum. I've had some contacts. And in the process of doing all this research, we were just contacting people right and left to get their stories. And then they would have people. And it was like a game of telephone almost. They would have people, and it would, right. They put them in contact with us. And we just reached out to so many people. You know, it was this is exactly why it took so long to do the research of the first book, because of that. And then imagine compiling all this,
right?
Too, all the information that we dug. I mean, how do we decide what's important, what isn't? How do we make it flow together? How do we you know, really see make this evolve into stories? How do we get this person's quote in there that was really cool, or things like that? And that's again why. When it came down to actually sitting down and actually putting the book together in 2012 to get it out in time, it was just so rushed that, you know, even we weren't happy with everything the way that went. We were very happy with the amount of information in there, and certainly how the book turned out overall. But for us, yeah, we're going to be extremely happy with the second edition of the book, because that's really going to be what our vision really was with this.
Well, it sounds like you've got your hands full trying to do that second edition of the first book, and then working on the second book and trying to get that out. You probably haven't even thought about the third book yet, I would imagine. Is that correct?
You know, and that was the thing too, because some of the people from the first book are part of the third book, because they continued on with Atari Games, the guys in Coin. And that was something we had to really decide, that when we were out there for interviews, you know, or conducting interviews too, do we go right into material for that third book, or do we cut them off? And we chose the cutting them off, because there just wasn't enough time. Like Ed Log, we could have kept going and going, but we had to cut off at 84, you know, and he was gracious enough, you know, all these people gracious enough to give their time to open up their homes to us, you know, and to take time out of their day to reminisce about something that happened to them a lot of years ago. Not everybody's willing to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, so no, we haven't really started with the, you know, with the third book too. It's not to say a lot of the material isn't there, because again, a lot of the documentation involved with that we already have, just like for the second book. But really, it's the way Kurt and I approach this is, you know, we start focusing in on specific main topics, and then really see, okay, where are the gaps? Or as we interview people, there'll be other things exposed that we didn't realize there was a gap before. So then we've got to go and do research for that, and so on. So, you know, a lot of things, like we're spending a lot of time right now focusing on that transition time. Really trying to, like with the first book, we wanted to dispel some very specific rumors, like the whole Atari Amiga deal and what happened there, which is what we dispelled in the first book. And then, or like what actually happened to bring Atari down, you know, which is something that we covered, you know, what actually went on there instead of the rumors. No, it wasn't Pac-Man, it wasn't E.T. Those are more symptoms of the problem. They weren't the actual cause of it. It wasn't just a glut of product on the market either. It was much more complicated than that. So we're doing the same thing in this book. You know, what actually went on in transition? What did Jack have to deal with? Because he actually, that first year, had to deal with a tremendous amount of crap thrown at him. That, you know, from what we're seeing, there's a number of times where that company could have gone under already. Whether it was, you know, it, like licensing, right off the bat, you got Nintendo coming after him because they say you owe us money because the transfer of product for Mario Brothers and for Donkey Kong, because, you know, there was the 8-bits, there were 8-bit computers, there were the Atari 2600 versions, and I can't remember the 7800 was done, version was being worked on at that time when that happened. But anyways, they basically, any transfer of product over to him, because it was an assets purchase, they counted as a sale. So he's immediately, according to Nintendo, he's immediately responsible for paying royalties on the sales of all those games he hasn't actually sold. Mm-hmm. So, or there's, you know, the no money down. Yeah, they gave him a no money down purchase, Warner, but on the same token, he had to take on the bulk of that debt, and they basically, any money to keep the company afloat, he put a lot of his own money in, and they gave him a bunch of the good debt too, and expected him to go and play collector and collect on those debts, which he wasn't able to do. So by the fall, he's having to already renegotiate with them again, because money that they claimed he was going to be able to use to keep the money, to keep the company going, wasn't available. So, you know, in all this stuff, you know, and another big rumor too was that Jack fired all these people, and that's what was reported in the newspaper as well, because they said he bought Atari. He didn't buy Atari. He bought a division. And even then, it was an assets purchase. People don't come with the assets purchase, with an assets purchase. What you normally do in an assets purchase, when you buy a company's assets, is you may hire people over to maintain those assets. But they're not, employees are not considered assets. They're employees. They, you know, that, and that's exactly, you know, it's a cold hard fact. That's how business looks at them. Employees aren't an asset. They're a money drain, because they're money that you're actually paying out that's coming into the company. You know, and that's, you know, I don't think a lot of people realize that that's how business normally looks at it. You know, it's very cold hearted. I don't share that view, but that, you know, that's how it was. So what happened was, they actually, Leonard Trammell, his son, and a lot of the people actually had to go and look to hire people over and do interviews with people, full aware that anybody that they didn't hire over was most likely going to be let go. And that's what happened with the bulk of the employees. That had been part of the consumer division, is they were let go and they got their final payments from Warner. So it's, you know, it's a lot of things like that that we're really taking our time and getting to the bottom to, and we want to get the picture more accurate than what's been told before. We've actually, you know, again, same as the last week, we started it with the same viewpoints as everybody else. Oh, Jack was this, you know, real hard-as-nails businessman that was supposedly an asshole, and he, you know, raked people over the coals, and he was real cheap, and he never did anything. And we're finding out that's not really an accurate picture. With what he was able to accomplish with this company in a short amount of time, how he was able to bring, to get rid of all that debt that he took on, make the company actually profitable, and really keep things going and restart a video games division too, because he actually wanted to keep it going. We found documentation on that too. They wanted to try and keep a minimal video game aspect going right from the beginning, including the 7800. He was actually planning on launching that at Christmas, and GCC, the people developer, we got confirmation on their side. He actually upped the order of parts from what Atari Inc. originally had wanted for it. So he was actually going to increase the order in the amount of consoles. But the problem was a lot of those deals, like GCC's deal or the Amiga deal and stuff like that, were actually through Warner. So they kept those. So, you know, a lot of people don't realize that, too.
I think that's contrary to popular belief. I think everyone thought once he came in, first thing he wanted to do was get rid of, you know, all the gaming and just concentrate on the computers.
Yeah, they actually hired on, kept on people on contract, several game developers, too. And they wound up leaving by September because it basically stalled out. The whole thing for the 7800, because of, again, GCC thought that Warner owed them the money because their contract was with Warner. GCC wanted Jack to pay, and he's like, well, no, you guys should be paying then. And they negotiated around and around, on again and off again, all the way until the spring of 85, when Jack finally capitulated and is like, okay, fine, I'll pay this because I want to move forward with this. And he paid the money. Then he had to pay for the 10 launch titles, and then he had to start to look for somebody to restart a video game division that summer of 85. So, you know, it's real interesting, a lot of the stuff that we found. Yeah, he was you know, tough as nails business guy. That's exactly why his motto was business is war. But there's you know, it was not one-dimensional by any means. There was a lot more to the story than what people realize, including the amount of money he put into stuff. Because we found a lot put into it too. It's you know, it's going to be an interesting story. You know, like another aspect we found too with Atari Corp is you actually have you might as well call Atari Corp three different companies, because you actually have three different generations to the company, including of staff, because you had a lot of the people that were hired over from Atari Inc. make up, along with the Commodore people, make up that first generation of the company. And a lot of those people left by 87, 88. Then you have another generation, and Jack had retired then as well and was mainly chairman of the board, so that Sam was doing the daily operations from 88 onwards. Then you have another generation that's really from about 88 to around 91 or so, 92. And then you have that final generation, which was when the company was so bare bones that it was towards the end of it. So, you know, we're finding out that aspect too. So we're learning new things along the way as well.
Well, it sounds like a tremendous amount of work to put these books together. But you know what? It sounds like a lot of fun, too. So hopefully you guys are having fun doing this.
Oh, we do, especially on interviews. They're the best parts, and especially the interviews we get to do in person. Because being there with these people when they're reminiscing, a lot of them still have materials that they've kept all these years, paraphernalia, et cetera, that they bring out, put on the table. That's actually what we try to capture with the original cover of Business is Fun. They'd lay the stuff out on the table and start reminiscing and, you know, just being a part of these. And, you know, what's universal too, especially with Atari Inc., was that what the people commonly say was it was not like any other place they've ever worked at before or since then. It was like a magical place to them. And it's, you know, it's something that they cherish to this day. And that's, again, why we do these books and why we do this stuff, because we want to really show, yeah, this was all magical for us, the fans and the people who use the products. It's certainly very magical for us, but it was also very magical for the people that work there.
Yeah, and that's unusual. Not everyone feels that way about, you know, where they worked, so... That's definitely a story worth telling.
Definitely.
Well, Marty, you know, I've taken a lot of your time here.
No problem.
I don't want to keep you too long. Is there anything else you want to leave with the audience or just mention before we go here?
Just that we thank everybody that has purchased the book. We thank everybody's positive comments, everybody's negative comments or criticism. You know, we take them all into consideration. And, you know, we're just as big a fans as all of you. And so, We hope you continue to support us in these books and, you know, anything else that we wind up doing in the future.
Yeah, well, I personally really appreciate all the work you guys are doing, because this is something I have a strong interest in. So it's great to read this story and all the work that you guys are putting into it. So, do you have any addresses or anything like that that you'll want to send me to put with this? Web addresses or contact info or anything like that?
The AtariBook.com address is great. We have a contact form on there that anybody can use. We're also, obviously, there's the Atari Museum Facebook group. You're welcome to share the URL for that. And the Atari 8 Businesses Fund Facebook page as well.
Okay, very good. Well, I very, very much appreciate your time, Marty. Well, thank you again, and we'll talk
no
again.
Problem.
All right, thanks. Have a good evening.
You too. Take care.
All right.